WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, filling in for Terry Gross. When I was a college senior at the University of Florida in 1975, taking an applied journalism course at the local newspaper, the Gainesville Sun, this weird guy walked into the newsroom one day. He was carrying a giant clear trash bag full of unshelled peanuts and handing them out to anybody he met. "I'm Jimmy Carter," he said with each handful, "and I'm running for President of the United States." Former President Jimmy Carter achieved that goal a year later. And this week, 22 years after leaving the White House, he received the Nobel Peace Prize. He was cited for his role in the Camp David Accord between Israel and Egypt in 1978 and for his later humanitarian work with the Carter Center, a private foundation dedicated to promoting peace. On today's Fresh Air, we'll listen back to excerpts of several of our interviews with him. Jimmy Carter has been one of the most sought-after mediators in the world, though he also has been criticized for cutting favorable deals with dictators. In Haiti, he negotiated an agreement with the military rulers which averted a U.S. invasion. Carter negotiated a ceasefire in Bosnia with the Bosnian Serbs. In North Korea, Carter helped defuse a nuclear crisis by negotiating a commitment with dictator Kim Il-sung to freeze their nuclear program. Although, as recent relations between North Korea and the U.S. have declined, North Korea has just announced they are rolling back on some of the restrictions that were negotiated in 1994. In 1995, Jimmy Carter told Terry Gross that he gets calls almost every month asking him to mediate conflicts. Terry asked him then what criteria he uses to decide if he'll accept an invitation.
Well, the first thing is that we have to be able to induce both sides to accept our presence. Usually we get a request or an importunity from one side, and then we go to the other side and say, "Are you willing now for us to participate? Do you really want to resolve this problem in a peaceful way instead of through continued war or the eruption of war?" That's the first step. The second step is to get permission or approval from my own government, either from the State Department or the White House. And in most cases, we are better able to get approval from the White House because the State Department is an enormous bureaucracy, and there is at least an insinuation in their mind that if some outsider comes in to address a problem, that it means that they have failed in their duties. So in most cases that have been highly publicized recently, we've had approval from President Clinton and some of his subordinates, but some opposition from other places within the government.
When you know that someone who you're about to negotiate with has violated all the promises they made in the past, how does that affect the way you handle the negotiations and the way you handle a promise that they're ready to make or a treaty that they're ready to offer?
Well, quite often we find that both sides violate agreements.
Mm-hmm.
And that the media coverage in our country is quite biased. We tend to have heroes and villains, and the heroes can do no wrong and the villains can do no right. What we do at the Carter Center is analyze all the world's conflicts. There are about 32 major wars now, and we try to learn on a sustained basis the causes of those conflicts, the people involved, the issues that must be addressed, and so forth. And almost invariably, these wars are civil wars within a country. And except on rare occasions where the United Nations Security Council has actually acted, it's not proper at all for a UN official even to talk to a revolutionary who's trying to overthrow a government that's a member of the United Nations. So we go where others don't want to go. And at the time we went to North Korea, there was actually a law in effect that prevented any American from going to Pyongyang to talk to the officials there. And as you know, we were on the verge of a mass invasion of Haiti when we went down to Haiti. So we try to keep an open mind, not condoning what has been done in the past, but setting up the procedure so that at the end of the mediation process, both sides win. If one side wins and the other side loses, then there's no way that an agreement can be preserved.
When you went to negotiate in Bosnia, Leon Panetta, the White House chief of staff, put it like this. He said, the Serb motives are suspect. And I'm certain many people agreed with him when he said that. You know, a lot of skeptics say that tyrants ask you to come because they think they'll get a better deal out of you. So what do you say to that?
Well, I don't have any deals to offer. And I never go without the approval of my government. And I never deviate from the policies of my government. And I'm not only very familiar with the reasons and background and personalities involved in conflicts, but I'm also very careful that I'm thoroughly familiar with my own nation's policy before I go into an arena of this kind. I've never deviated from that. Also, I don't want any authority. I have zero authority. I just go as a private citizen, as a professor at Emory University, as a member of the Carter Center. And this is very important to me. When I conclude any sort of agreement, it has to be approved word by word with the authorities in charge, both sides to a dispute, or in this particular case, by the United Nations representatives there, and also by my government. And for instance, when we negotiated at the last minute after an attack had already been launched against Haiti, every word in the agreement that I worked out there with Emile Jonassant, the provisional president, was approved by a group of people in the Oval Office, including the president, the vice president, the secretary of state, and a national security advisor. So I don't want any authority. I don't need any authority. I don't have anything to offer. I try to represent the Carter Center well and make sure that everything I do is completely compatible with the policies of my government.
Let me ask a question that I'm sure a lot of people have wondered about. You have such a strong human rights record. What is it like for you to sit opposite someone like Karadžić, knowing the war crimes that he's guilty of? Is it more difficult for you to negotiate with somebody who you think of as a tyrant?
Well, there are two or three phases. One is the preparation for it. And the second phase after I get there is an extensive listening process. I have to listen to their position and understand them. And then I weigh in with basic demands. My rationality, if I need any of it, is that if a war is going on, we terminate the war. If a war is imminent, as was the case in Haiti and North Korea, we try to prevent the war. If terrible human rights violations have occurred in the past, we try to make an environment possible within which the human rights violations will be totally eliminated or dramatically reduced. And I think that's a standard that we fill. And whether someone has been guilty in the past of starting a war or committing human rights atrocities is obviously a very serious matter for us to consider, but we try to end those practices and bring peace and the alleviation of human rights suffering.
Do you have to enter negotiations with someone who is a tyrant in a fairly non-judgmental way and be as cordial and open as you possibly can?
Well, I'm cordial and open. The only thing I have to offer is my own integrity and an element of objectivity. I don't have any axe to grind. My axe is to try to bring peace and an end to human rights abuses. But it doesn't mean that I go in ignorant of past crimes. And I have to just realize that these people have committed crimes. In most cases, crimes have been committed on both sides. They may be much more onerous on one side than the other. But quite often it's the scorned person or the despised person or the unsavory people in international judgment that will need someone to listen to their position, as was the case with Kim Il-sung and with the provisional government in Haiti and as with the Bosnian Serbs.
Jimmy Carter, speaking in 1995 with Terry Gross. Carter accepted the Nobel Peace Prize earlier this week. We'll hear more from Jimmy Carter after a break. This is Fresh Air. Jimmy Carter accepted the Nobel Peace Prize earlier this week. In 1993, Terry asked him about becoming president.
What was the most disorienting part of your first day and night in the White House?
I had pretty well gotten my cabinet firmed up quite early after the election. And What do you do the next day to deal with a multitude of issues? I had a very fine agenda. I couldn't get much support originally from the Congress, although finally my batting average was about the same as Lyndon Johnson's or John Kennedy. You know, what do you do when you get in the Oval Office? I hardly knew where it was. Or I had visited it once before. President Ford invited me in to see the Oval Office after I had won the election. I have to say, though, as a bottom line, that I was quite confident of myself. I wasn't plagued with trepidation that I was inadequate for the job. That may be presumptuous, but anybody who decides I want to be president of this great country has to be somewhat presumptuous. So I wasn't plagued with an inferiority complex. I felt that no matter what came up, that I could handle it as well as anyone.
What about during the hostage crisis? Was there ever a point where you wished that you weren't president, where you wished that you didn't have this terrible burden on your shoulders?
Well, about 2 o'clock in the morning in April when we tried the rescue operation and and we couldn't succeed, that was perhaps the high point of despair in my presidency. And I knew that I had to get up early the next morning, about 6 o'clock, and prepare to go on all the morning talk shows and explain to the American people that the rescue operation had failed. That was a very dismal point. Also, we knew that an accident had occurred and that one of the helicopters had flown into an airplane and that 8 people had died. And I had to notify those families during the night that their loved ones had perished in a secret operation. There's no way that anything else that happened during the 4 years could equal that as a time of discouragement and despair.
Yeah. You told us a little bit about what your inauguration day was like. Let's skip ahead to the inauguration of your successor, Ronald Reagan. What were you feeling that day as you realized that the hostages were going to be released on his watch, not on yours?
Well, I didn't realize that. I had not been to bed for 3 days and had negotiated in the most meticulous detail the release of the hostages. Everything was all agreed, and the hostages were in the airplane ready to take off at 10 o'clock that morning, Washington time. So we were just waiting to get word that they had cleared Iranian airspace. And when I went to the reviewing stand, when I relinquished the presidency to Reagan and he made his inaugural speech, before I left the reviewing stand, I was informed that the plane had indeed taken off and the hostages were all safe and free. I have to say that I didn't even think about the fact that it happened a few minutes after midnight, after noontime. I just knew that they were free, and that was one of the most glorious and happy moments of my entire life.
Even though it wasn't on your watch?
Well, to me, I didn't even think about it, but obviously that became the major story among the news media, that it happened about 20 minutes after I was no longer president. To me, that was insignificant, but it has still prevailed. Even your question indicates that it was a historically important fact that it happened a few minutes after I left the White House as a president rather than while I was still in office.
My guest is former President Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, before we go any further, I'm going to ask you for a little lesson in etiquette. Do I call you President Carter, Mr. President, our former President Jimmy Carter? What is the appropriate etiquette when you're talking to a former President of the United States?
You know, one of the nice things about our country is you can call me anything you want to. Jimmy suits me okay. There is a custom in our nation that if you are have been a governor or an ambassador or a judge or president, then you can still retain the title. So if you want to call me president, you can. If you want to call me Jimmy, that's fine. You know, when I go through Georgia small towns and somebody is an old friend of mine, I know it immediately when they say, "Hi, governor." They call this. that's whatever the most intimate relationship is. And the little kids around Plains, when I ride a bicycle or jog by, if they are very devout, or if their families go to church every Sunday, they call me Brother Jimmy. Hello, Brother Jimmy. And a lot of them just call me, "Hello, Jimmy Carter." But it doesn't matter to me. I never was much dependent on the pomp and ceremony of the White House, even when I was there. And so Jimmy suits me fine.
Jimmy Carter, speaking with Terry Gross in 1993. Carter is a born-again Christian, and his religious beliefs have always been an important part of his life. In 1996, Terry spoke with him about his book, Living Faith.
How did you approach your prayer life in the White House? You say in your book that other presidents have brought in Billy Graham to organize worship for them, but you didn't want to do that in the White House. You thought it violated your sense of separation of church and state. So what did you do?
Well, I worshiped as I would if I had not been in public life at all. I went to Sunday services at the First Baptist Church in Washington, which was the nearest Baptist church to the White House. Most of the weekends we tried to go to Camp David. We had a chaplain from a nearby Army base come and preach a sermon. We sang hymns together. And as far as my personal prayer life was concerned, I would say it was much more frequent and maybe on the average more heartfelt than ever, any other time in my life, because I felt that the decisions I made were affecting the lives of hundreds of millions of people. I never prayed for popularity. I never prayed to be reelected, things of that kind. I prayed that I could keep my nation at peace. I prayed that I could extend the advantages of peace to other people, say, between Egypt and Israel at Camp David. When the hostage crisis came along, the prayer that I made was that all the hostages would come back home safe and free, that I would not betray the principles of my nation or do anything to embarrass it. And I think in all those cases, my prayers were answered. I think God always answers our prayers. Quite often, God's answer is no. We don't get what we ask for. And then the obligation, if we have faith, is to find out within ourselves why. Are we asking for selfish things? Are we asking for things that are unjustified? Are we asking for things that ought to be granted in the future? Should we change the priorities in our lives? Are our prayers in accordance with God's will? Those are the kind of things that I've learned over a long lifetime, as you know. And those are the things I try to describe in Living Faith.
What was your sense of prayer when you were a child, and how has your sense of prayer changed as an adult?
Well, when I was a child, say when I reached the age of 10 or teenage life, I had some very serious doubts about what I heard in church, what I heard in Sunday school, what I heard my own father teaching. But I wouldn't express my doubts to anybody. And I thought I was very sinful not to have absolute and total faith. Now my faith is stronger. I can see the various aspects of a deep Christian faith. I realize that as I was at the age of 15, I'm still searching. I'm still trying to learn. I'm still trying to stretch my heart, stretch my mind. I learned two or three times in my life that my faith could sustain total doubt in God. I rejected God a few times. I felt that God had betrayed me, that I could not depend on my faith at all. And I had to go through a very difficult and unpleasant healing process. I've learned over a period of a long lifetime, 50 years of marriage with Rosalind, how sadly mistaken I was in dealing with her. When we first got married, I was an arrogant young Naval Academy graduate. Rosalind was a very shy, timid, younger person from Plains, Georgia. I totally dominated her. I didn't show any sensitivity when she was distressed. I was just impatient. When decisions were to be made about our family's life, I didn't consult with her. I just made a decision and informed her what we were going to do. And that was in my formative stage as a mature human being. I've learned to correct some of those mistakes. So prayer life for me has paralleled in awareness and growth and in significant my evolution as a human being. And I hope that I'll continue to improve in the remaining years that I have.
Jimmy Carter, speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. Carter was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize this week. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.